The theme for the afternoon talk is listening, silence, reflection. And I hope you can hear right at the back. If you can't, you may have to move a bit closer. Just like to take a couple of minutes initially, and bear with me on the specific situation here of recent months, and I want to use it as the fact, of course, as the view, but also and equally as something of a metaphor as well. And in the time at the end of December and into January, I was at home in England, and from there I flew to India, and perhaps like a number of you and other people in the area, found myself waking up at night deeply disturbed and deeply troubled by the events that were taking place in Israel and by the Israeli government and the IDF. Not only for all the Palestinians there and for all the events that took place, but also, of course, and equally on behalf of the soldiers who were sent in there. And from the reading, and lots of it, from the newspapers, from watching Al Jazeera on television, from the various emails that were sent to me from various parts of the world, and from 17 years of coming here to Israel and having listened to literally thousands and thousands of Israelis' hearts and minds in many kinds of situations in this country, as well as many dialogues, the one of the many areas I feel concerned about is a kind of, not everywhere, not with everyone, I'm quite aware of that, of a kind of deafening silence that is coming from the civilians of Israel. That in my visits over the years, I can say hand on heart here, that the amount of reference to the plight of the Palestinians, to the actions of the Israeli government and the IDF, to what's happening today in Gaza, gradually, the voice of the citizens of Israel has got quieter and quieter and quieter. That when I was here a year ago, for about the same period of time, just under 3 weeks, working every day, talking to people every day, talking with people and their situations and their experiences, it wasn't until the last evening of the last day of the very last question that was put to me of the thousands that were, in which the word Palestinian, Arab, or Gazan was mentioned. The silence is not the silence of reflection. It's not the silence of any inquiry. It's the silence of the graveyard. It's the silence of the mortuary. It's the silence of the abattoir. And when that happens, understandably and tragically, governments, whether it's a democratic government, so-called or otherwise, know that they have the people in the position that they want them to be in, either agreeing and voting for them, whether it's Labour or Likud or whoever it might be on the one side, or saying nothing. And history, anyone who's explored history and looked at history knows that evil in any form, that is the merciless killing of men, women and children, can only take place when people remain silent, when people have given up, when people have said, I can't handle it anymore, when people have withdrawn from that engagement for love, for truth and for justice. And it's a great pity here in Israel from my experience and my listening, I'm just a small voice of the visitor, but a regular one, that so many people say to me directly, Christopher, I don't want to talk about it. Christopher, don't mention the word peace. Don't mention the word justice. Don't mention the word war crimes. Don't mention the word conflict. Don't mention Arabs. Don't mention Palestinians. Don't mention Muslims. I can't handle it anymore. It's too much. That's just what governments want you to feel and to think. Because when the message goes out again and again, one ends up with thoughtful citizens becoming the most obedient citizens by their silence. And that's what's happened here. I remember when we used to go to Nablus, in the times when it was easier for both Israeli citizens and international people to go before all the blockages made it very, very difficult. And the Palestinians in Nablus, in Shrem, used to say to me, our great wish is what happened in the United States will happen here in Israel. That when the United States engaged in its war against the people of Vietnam, many, many people were on the streets, day in and day out, a huge campaign to stop this war and to find some reconciliation with the Vietnamese people and with the Laotian people. I was in the war, covering the war as a reporter in Laos when the Americans were having their secret war there. And we hope, this is the Palestinians, that Israeli citizens will start themselves to find ways for real reconciliation and not keep justifying this terror that is taking place in your name. There's very little sign of it. There's some precious and beautiful human beings in Israel who work for reconciliation, who work for justice, but unfortunately and very, very sadly, there's the death of it through the silence. It's become a graveyard. Dharma teaching, it's a rough business. I'm not concerned so much with the politics. I'm only concerned with the suffering. I'm concerned that men and women really dig deep into ourselves. What can I do as a human being to bring about the ending of the suffering? And the moment I blame another, I'm a contributor to the suffering. I'm well aware of the obscenity of the sending of the rockets from Gaza. Change will not come from anywhere but from people who stand up and question. And if you remain silent, it's a tragic situation. And similarly, when I was in France during the summer, I was speaking with an Israeli, I think it was a news producer or announcer. And he said to me, oh, it's all right for you, Christopher. Your country hasn't been at war since the end of the Second World War. Did I ever hear such a person who was so out of touch with history? The country that I come from, the United Kingdom, has not stopped being at war. It's constantly been sending soldiers overseas. It's constantly been involved in conflict. Constantly had the terror attacks through the conflict with the people in Northern Ireland and in the island of Ireland. And so when we're speaking of the preciousness of silence, we're not talking of the silence of the graveyard, the silence of giving up questioning. We're speaking about listening, silence for reflection and inquiry, and the change that can emerge out of the being in that kind of movement. And so when we look here and explore, there'll be times for inquiry, and you can give me a very hard time for anything I might have said. I'll appreciate it. One of the people, just take a sidestep for a moment, in the last retreat, I rather liked it. He said he had done a Goenka course. Some of you know Goenka course. I regarded it as a holiday camp by other people when I did one 30 years ago. But other people felt it's very strict, like a police state, you hear this, and you've got to sit for so many hours a day and watch your sensations and fit in. So one person had done one of Goenkaji's retreats. I didn't actually see it like that, but that was the view that's off that was said. And others would say the same view sometimes. So he says he's come and he fitted in. So he said to me, I've come here and I'm in rebellion. When other people sit, I walk. When they walk, I sit. He said, I don't want to fit in. I'm just rebelling against the structure. I'm rebelling against the form. And I said to him, wonderful. Rebel. Excellent. And he said, oh no, now I've got nothing to rebel against. Sometimes in the voice of protest, in the voice of rebellion, in the Buddhist world, which I find wretched, that sometimes the culture of niceness is all pervasive. It's killing protest. It's killing the voice of change because it said, oh, he's so upset. Oh, he's so angry. It's so negative. And you go, oh God, I better go and see my therapist. I better go and do another retreat because I'm protesting. I shouldn't do that. I'm agitated. I shouldn't feel that. I should just sit on it. And that's what people do. They sit on it and they become painfully nice people. Life isn't nice. It's about suffering. It's about issues. It's about conflict. It's about resolution. It's about engagement. It's about love. It's about compassion. Don't be afraid to feel. Don't be afraid to feel. Don't let those wretched propaganda voices get to you. Don't submit to it. When we were coming in with Rennie in the car, but last minute, then I go on to something else, I promise. We were coming Rennie in the car. I said, what's that place there? She says, I said, it's a prison. She said, yeah, it's a prison. She said, it's a prison where young Israeli men who have refused to go into uniform, refused to fight, refused to go into the occupied territories, refused to go into Gaza, they're in there. So sometimes small groups of people stand outside and make some protest about it. What on earth is a state doing? Locking up its young citizens for their right to be non-violent. What treatment is that of people? Enough. Just. In the tradition, and in the very long tradition, this threefold exploration is very much a kind of thread and theme. Listening. Silence. The reflection via the silence. And the outcome. I'm just in one of the groups today. It's always lovely hearing in the great network of teachers and teachings and practices, this person, as others as well, have been to Dharamsala in northern India. And I remember when I was up there, lifetimes ago, I was in the shaven-headed, orange-robed club at the time. And there's a place called Tushita Meditation Center. Some of you will know it up there. So they offer a 10-day program, of course. So I've never done one, but so forgive me for reflecting the gossip. And from what I understand, there's a huge amount of listening going on. And Tibetans, bless them, and Asians in general, they don't have, you know, limits or boundaries to talking. They go on, and they go on, and they go on. My Thai teacher's like, on. So you listen a lot, and it's a little bit like good food. You know, it's nice to see some slices of bread, by the way, today. Yes. So it's like if you've got the same food coming in, eventually you get filled up, don't you? And you say, look, stop. You know, I'm trying to digest all this about the hell realms and whatever, or karma, or the Four Noble Truths, or practices, all the incredible things, the Buddhist tradition, emptiness and form. You know, tradition's phenomenal for its exploration. Look, stop, stop. Tibetans never heard the word stop. And I once asked, sidestep here, to some of my beloved Tibetan friends, what was the longest talk you ever listened to? I was in one of these large Tibetan centers. And one said, it's the teacher. I knew who the teacher was immediately because he had the reputation. I won't mention his name. I'm a polite Englishman. And the teacher said, and the friend said, he started at 5:30 in the evening. And he finished at 1:30 in the morning. And it was boring. And so sometimes we listen and 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 listen. And we're receiving, receiving, receiving. And in it, as this good person said today, a couple of weeks after the 10 days, having digested it, in the digestion of some understanding, some insight, some clarity, and the real benefits start to emerge. And the tradition, as I mentioned, has said that in the course of time, we're talking now long, 2,000-3,000 years, this relationship is a very precious relationship between the Dharma as a teaching, the silence subsequent to it, and our presence and our stillnesses, and using that as a vehicle, as a means, I want to talk about this, for reflection. And from the combination of our silence with some intentional applied reflection, some real insight and understanding and benefit can come. And it's important that we use this. And one of my, if I may say, a few years ago, small intentions to give support to this was that I switch from the talk in the evening to this, around this time at 4 o'clock, from one primary intention to give everybody a little bit more time for some more reflection, and hopefully something in it is said, is touched upon, is reflected upon. Maybe yes, maybe no. So in the act of the listening here, there's the outer listening and the inner listening. And with the outer listening that takes place, and I find for this for myself in daily life, that though I may see and think differently to what I listen to, that regularly, even though I may do something differently, I want to connect in with essentially what she or he is saying to me. Is it well-intentioned? Is it well-intentioned? And quite often one sees in personal relationships here that somebody does something differently. And we've got to pick up the well-intentionality of it. I mean, to take, you know, some small little examples here. Each time that I go away, you nearly always have house sitters in my house. And one of my dearest friends in Totnes, he's known as a serial house sitter because he's house sitting for you. And other friends come to stay. And when one arrives home, often, can I find things in my kitchen? Can I? I don't know where they've hidden them. I leave in my little pathetic little order. This goes in there, and this cupboard in here, and this. And when I arrive home, there's somewhere else. And I don't think they're putting things elsewhere to wind me up. I mean, you know, they're friends. So yeah, there. They put them what they think is a proper good place, or even better place than they were before. And many other things in life. So something is said to us, oh, I've just done this. I've just done that. Whatever it might be. And I want to hear the voice. The Buddha speaks about this a lot. I want to hear the voice. Even though my view of it could be done better, or it could be done different, or actually I didn't even ask you to do it. But if I can hear the voice of well-intentionality and tune into that voice, I'm less likely to get agitated, self-righteous, into an argument with the other person. Because the well-intentionality in Dharma is that the intention is that there is no suffering, no harm, no pain is being inflicted, and there's no support for it. That's called well-intentionality. And if I can pick that up with my mother, or with my daughter, with my grandkids, with my friends, my partner, with my neighbours, with the Sangha, whatever, pick up the well-intentionality there, even though it's different, then I can abide with a certain silence, a certain receptivity, and I'm not going to come from a place of agitation towards. And some of you will be sitting on this retreat, a story will come up about somebody in your life, it's almost a guarantee, and you'll be looking at, why did she or he say this? What did he or she mean by this? Why are he or she like this? And if you get caught in the story, you may overlook, perhaps, there's some well-intentionality behind it. And if you think it's not that, if you think it's revenge, if you think it's just that they're plain angry and they want to hurt you, if you think there's some other manipulative motive there at work, and that's what you're picking up, you may be right or wrong, then you ask the person. You try to check it out with the person. You try to ask as kindly as possible for some clarification. But as I say, sometimes it's fairly obvious, it's well-intentionality. We have to listen to that with each other. So our silence, not the silence of the dead, but the silence of awareness, the silence of receptivity, is really listening to much more than the content. Content is important, but it's also listening to what accompanies it, and we've got to practice that kind of listening. And it's a terrible pity in life if anyone in this room is currently refusing to speak to somebody. Just because our politicians do it in their childish, self-righteous manner, refusing to speak to the other. We don't have to behave so childishly. We need to check and to look and to ask ourselves. So that in our silence, it's a silence of receptivity. It's a silence of interest. It's a silence which helps to reveal, to bring out, to allow to come into being. Because love is a feature which emerges out of authentic silence. And sometimes you and I, with people in this world, we have some bridge building to do. There's no point in coming to the end of a meditation retreat and one of the three of us sitting here and sending out loving kindness to all beings, except to him, or her, or them, or however. And we have, and it's terribly easy in this Dharma world that in the silences that take place, and in the listening to take place, we slip easily into kind of these Buddhist sweet generalizations. My dear friends always poke fun at me because I often say, oh, at the end we'll have a 3 or 4 minute loving kindness meditation, you know, just a few breadcrumbs. But the aspect of it is, the challenge for us is not in sweet loving kindness meditations to all beings, as rather beautiful it can be there. But what about in the realities? What about with those people in life who arise in your meditations? And that might require, in the silences that we're engaged in, some real reflection. Where have I gone cold? Where am I in the graveyard? Who have I put into the graveyard? What is going to help change that? And sometimes in life, others may cut us dead. Others may not want to say a single word to us ever again. Others may be regretting that we were born. Whatever. That we're an aberration of the species. An evolutionary mistake or something. But we, men and women of practice, still had to keep the heart open. I just came back from Germany. I hear this story a lot, I have to say. And this is where I say the listening, the silence which is alive and receptive, and the reflection. And a woman said to me that she's had a very good friend for many years. And they just had a weekend together. And they've been really good friends. And then at the breakfast table on the final morning, she and a friend got into a bit of an argument over something trivial. Just got into an argument. And by the end of the breakfast, they said, stupid and silly, we're such good friends. And it appeared to have been forgotten. The following day, my friend received a text from her, which is a brutal way of communication. Received a text from her, said, I can't handle any more communication with you. Don't get back to me. I don't want to have any more contact with you at all. End of message. And she was, why cut somebody off like that? And she couldn't understand it. Been friends for years, had a lovely weekend together, a bit of an argument at the breakfast, and then boom, this message is sent on a text to her. And I just, what to do? Not for me to tell somebody else what to do, though I tend to. Forgive me. But all that one can, I say, in this situation is, despite the distance, the coldness, the reaction that we may experience from another, let's endeavor to rise above this. This is the transcendent potency of us. In such a way that we can say, and we can put hand and heart, okay, this person is closed off But nevertheless, let me, though I am told to be silent, just send one small communication. If at any time you wish to reconnect with me, I'm available for you. If at any time you wish to renew the friendship, please don't hesitate to contact me. With lots of love. To keep a way of being, because we listen to each other, through our silence, we keep something alive. It's called love, no matter what. Just before leaving here, one person told me, a mother, single mother, it's in England, there are lots of single mothers in England. My daughter's joined the tribe. 3 children, 2 fathers. Could be worse. And this woman got pregnant. And the man, far too many men are very immature. Not only politicians, by the way. Sorry, all right. And he couldn't cope with it. And he completely withdrew. No support, no word, no contact, etc. Even though it was easy for him. After 10 years, he felt he got over his upset, his anger, his blame, his withdrawal, and he contacted his ex-partner, now a mother with a 10-year-old. And the first thought in her mind, she told me, was, he's been absolutely cut off, totally distant. Yeah. Why should I let him have any contact with my child? Mother doesn't have the right to deny access from the person whose heart has changed. It's different if there's violence threatened towards the child. It's different, of course. The man, after 10 years, had some change of heart. And that change of heart went from coldness and silence and distance to wishing to renew and start a role, a friendship and love and give support. The heart must be big enough to see change in the heart of another and to accommodate it. Listening, silence and reflection. Personally, socially, politically, globally, we have to engage in this process. In the body of the teachings, the exploration through the listening to each other. And sometimes I find for myself at home, I have a TV. My mother had given me a television, and I had it for 25 years. And at that time, until a couple of years ago, it was balanced on an old TV stand, which didn't fit. It was just 25 years. So it just been in this house 26, 27 years. It's kind of balanced on the top. And one day, I came rushing in my usual unmindful way. It's so easy teaching mindfulness. So I go rushing in, and the television, it just fell off the top, and it crashed into smithereens. You know, and funny, have a look. I opened up the back of the television. You know, there's nothing in it. I mean, it's a complete proof of emptiness. You know, what? And there's not much difference between the screen with pictures and when it's turned off, you know. But inside, look at Well, no, if you look inside, there's just a few little bits of glass bottle down the bottom. Anyway, so after a few months, a year, whatever, I got another television. Just coming back, sometimes with television, I have this small two-seater sofa, and I plonk myself like the yogi, cross-legged, there, and watch something on television. And sometimes just total attention to the watching. And it may be a documentary or a report or film or whatever. Truth can come in many forms. And sometimes just in the sitting, there, just cross-legged, total attention to watching, having, hopefully, the quiet discipline at the end of the program to switch the bloody thing off. You know, sometimes there's no energy left. You should end up watching more than one wanted to. One always needs an energy just to see if I've got enough energy to press the off button there. And sometimes out of the total attention of real presence, and then stopping, and then there's some silence, and just feeling inside what has touched one. What is one responding to in that? Sometimes what steps can I make? And it doesn't matter what the gesture is, but something can emerge out of it. You know, sometimes some of us are fans of YouTube, so I watch the things on YouTube. And if I may say, I wrote an inauguration address for the President of the United States there. He didn't read it. I can't make it out. And then it said that the President of the United States receives 40,000 letters a day. I don't care. One just sends. Whatever it's now it's 40,001. Doesn't matter. So sometimes we watch. There is some response inside. One may say it's futile. It's not. It's not futile. It's an expression of concern. It's an expression of love. It's an expression of pointing to things which the president may not know about because he's only getting briefs from people who have a very particular partisan view. And so through the listening, the radio, the television, the YouTube, the teachings, the practices or whatever, through that we need some time for the silence. And through the silence, we need some time for some reflection and for something to emerge from us. And we're deeply interested in what emerges. What is reflection? There's the listening. There's the silence. The silence of the conscious human being. And then there's the reflection. The act of the reflection often in the act of it will in as it were, what emerges quite often, and this isn't easy for us, it challenges the position which we have already. That's what reflection tends to do. So if you and I have a very fixed view, whatever, and that view in some way is destructive, some way it's fearful, it's not very clear, it's anxious, it's guilty, it's agitated or whatever, and there's the view that goes with it. Or just the feeling of concern. The reflection in this, what is it that I need to be clear about? What do I need to understand here? What is a fresh way of looking at that situation? And what the tradition has said, that the silence is a vehicle or a doorway. And what I mean by that is that in the reflection, we don't look for a rapid answer. We don't say, oh, I engage in some reflection and, oh, next minute, the old flashes of insight and awakening are going to emerge. Sometimes we ask the question, what needs to change here? What is the view that shows wisdom? What do I need to open the heart up to? What do I need to question, inwardly or outwardly? And from the mode of the quiet reflection, consciousness returns itself, so to speak, into the silence. Not a silence which is moved away from the question. And we just kind of rather quietly and totally listen in deeply. There may be no response. But one thing is, we're not just going along on the status quo of what the mind is telling us. We may have tendency towards doing too much, wanting too much, blaming others, blaming ourselves, feeling afraid, unwilling to speak up, conforming, numbing out. We notice that in ourselves, closing a person off, closing others off. We may notice that in ourselves. And then we ask, whatever the form of the question, what is another way to look at this? And we ask it slowly and carefully and mindfully. And then we return back into the silence. And we just rest with it. And it takes a certain listening, a certain mindfulness and presence, and maybe something fresh and new may emerge. And that view, the freshness, may really challenge us. But we're beginning to transcend a restriction, a limited place, a finite condition, a restricted one. And therefore we're opening up to our infinite potential, and the Dharma is concerned about the revelation of the infinite. So we listen outwardly. We go back into the silence. We listen inwardly. We go back into the silence. We reflect. We go back into the silence. And sometimes, of course, in all of this. And yesterday evening, though I don't know the Hebrew apologies here, but I did hear the lovely Sakya Muni mentioned in Mikhail's introduction. And Sakya, she said, is the tribe of North India. And Muni, its original meaning, is the silent one. So he's the silent one of the Sakyans, which is slightly ironic for somebody who, for whom they're attributed 11,000 discourses. But it's the world of the language, the movement of words between human beings, passing from, in this case, my mouth to your ears and to your inner life. That extraordinary event of the movement of language and the receptivity, that the language as it moves and as it is received and as it enters, it has to touch somewhere. It touches somewhere in you. It touches somewhere for the speaker. And we endeavor to find a kind of, with our meditations, a receptive and fertile field, not to adopt an ideology, not to set up a whole set of core beliefs like religion has done, and they just depend on a few words. If you take Christianity and you took out the word God, Jesus, the Bible, and the church, then what? Then what? Just hanging on a few words, a whole whatever. So we're not here to do that. What we are here is that in the receptivity and in the inner field, in listening outwardly and equally listening inwardly, something may touch the being. And in our reflection, it gives extra nourishment to that, and something beautiful may flower again and again for us. And the sign of it, and the preciousness of it is, one recognizes, another great aspect of the teaching here, one recognizes that the old, which was problematic and difficult, has been transformed, and there is a sense of new potentials and new possibilities and new discoveries and new ways of being. I'm not talking about anything, you know, mega dramatic here. I'm talking about the ordinary stuff of life. And certainly in my time in the years of going to the East and the privilege of 3.5 decades of teaching, these meeting points between our inner and outer listening, our silences, our reflections, and our meditations. And when nothing major is happening, when the inner world is rather quiet and rather receptive, and we feel inwardly alive and alert, and we're not dwelling on anything whatsoever, in the clarity and in the calmness of just that sense of steadiness and real inner peace, in this, even though it might disturb that inner peace and calm which one's practiced and worked so hard to achieve, but even in this, it can really be worthwhile bringing in a reflection. What else is this revealing? What is this calm state of being about? Is there anything that could come through this? And though we're abiding in a real unknown here, but in our silence and stillness, it would be a pity to think, ah, that's it. I am silence, or I am stillness, or I am a calm abiding, or I am at peace with myself. Precious, beautiful, profound, deep as it may be, it's not the fulfillment of human aspiration. It's an open door. So therefore, even in the depth, and some, lovingly and preciously, are quite willing, the meditator, the yogi, quite willing just to abide very calmly and steadily, not even to bring up a thought of reflection. And somehow, in that calm abiding, just see what life brings through it. What does that lovely inner space, what does that make it possible to bring through? And that's why we have these wonderful resources of inner and outer listening. Silence, which is potent and alive. Reflections and meditations. Why? To bring the very best out of our humanity. May all beings love the act of listening. May all beings listen to the depths of the being. May may all beings engage in the process of waking up. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes together.